Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
And welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here for checking out the series. You know what to do. If you like what you see, what you hear, hit that subscribe button. I put out new interviews like this one every single week, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists. Discover some new ones. You can grab us anywhere you get your podcast from. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org. Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. Subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. We've had some great guests here lately. Nadia Natasha was just here to talk about her new record, the members of Creedence Clearwater Revival. Peyton List, you're seeing her right now in School Spirits and Cobra Kai. Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age. Sam Yeager from Parenthood, Handmaid's Tale, and Wolfman. We also talk with members of Genesis, Sonic Youth, Heart, the B-52s, Pavement, an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's a special Rewind episode as we look back at my interviews with members of the Foo Fighters, the band that rose from the ashes of grunge to become rock's most reliable hitmakers and festival headliners. But beyond Dave Grohl's frontman glow, it's guys like Chris Shiflett and the late, great Taylor Hawkins who gave the band its heartbeat and bite. Shiflett's slick guitar work brought a sharp edge to their sound, while Hawkins' explosive drumming, larger-than-life personality, made him the band's not-so-secret weapon. And together, they helped shape the Foo Fighters into more than just Grohl's post-Nirvana project. They became a rock institution. And we're looking back on my interviews with Taylor Hawkins and Chris Shiflett. Now, we're going to start with Taylor. We recorded this one back in 2010. He was releasing one of his Taylor Hawkins and the Coattail Riders albums. It's called Red Light Fever. It's still my favorite that he ever did. We got to talk about the album's classic rock sound, having Queen's Brian May and Dave Grohl play on some of the songs, and if he considered playing any of these tracks for the Foo Fighters. So let's take this trip back in time, starting in 2010, with Taylor Hawkins. It's Kyle Meredith with Foo Fighters.
Hi, Kyle. How are you, buddy?
So with this new record, Red Light Fever, did you know what you wanted with this record to sound like when you were going into it? It's got a great classic rock sound. I was curious if that was kind of the idea of it.
Well, not necessarily. I didn't really have any preconceived ideas other than the songs, you know, but as far as production and everything, I wasn't sure. I just knew that I wanted to have a lot of harmonies, and I wanted it to be, you know, real colorful, because the last record had this sort of almost grodgy sort of black and whiteness to it, which was cool. Well, almost like The Knack or something, mm-hmm. like the last record, you know. But I wanted this one to be real colorful and sort of pristine and pretty almost, you know, even in its darkest parts, you know. I wanted it to be kind of, not glossy, but like overproduced in a good way, not in a bad way, not auto-tuned and not, you know, drums fixed on the computer type overproduced, but overproduced in like kind of more of a 70s way. And I think that's what kind of gives it that feel, you know?
Did you record the whole thing live, or was this kind of done in layers?
It was layered. It was absolutely layered. I mean, there's a couple things that are a little bit live, a couple bass and drum tracks that are live, but for the most part, it's pretty, you know, overdubbed.
Now, you actually got some of the kings of that style in the studio. I mean, well, I say kings. You actually had Queen in the studio. Is that right?
Yeah, I had some of the queens of it in the studio. Yeah, well, they weren't actually in the studio. It was more via, you know, the interweb.
How did that come about?
Well, we've known them a while. You know, they've gotten up on stage with the Foo Fighters and played with us countless times over in Europe and in England. And I played on Brian May's solo record and you know, just they're just friends, and I made this record, and I wanted to have, you know, some color and some other colors on this record, and I called Brian, and I said, will you play on a couple tracks? And he said, yeah, because I had just played on a couple tracks that he was doing. He's producing this girl named Carrie Ellis, some singer over in England, and I played drums via the interweb on a couple of her tracks, And it was just kind of like, it's fun to do that. You know, you can do that nowadays, and you just kind of like swap each. It's almost like writing letters to each other, you know, and you just kind of write this musical letter and, you know, add your bit to it, write me back, and they write back, and I take it and I put it on a song, and I got this. And all of a sudden, it sounds a little bit like Queen, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, he did. Yeah, he did some fantastic stuff on it. Really,
absolutely.
Bring, yeah. Did you write these songs alone, or do you write them with the band?
A little bit of both. I mean, everybody's kind of important in what they put on the songs, you know. But the Germany idea comes from me. Dave Grohl actually helped me a lot with it. He actually played a lot of rhythm guitar, and he had a lot to do with the arrangement.
Right.
So, I mean, the basic germ of the song, the lyrics, and the basic framework of the melody and the grooves came from my basic knowledge of songwriting, and then he kind of helped me sort of shape them a little bit more, and then the other guys came in and did their part too.
Was there a lot of work that went into those arrangements? I mean, certain parts sound definitely pretty complex.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yes and no. I mean, it came easy to a certain degree, but at the same time, there was a bit of work, and you know, Dave's really good. He's like the lone arranger. He really is. He can arrange a song. He really can, obviously, as we've seen in the past. So, and that's kind of why I asked him to help, you know, to sort of help produce this record. And he just, you know, he kind of took my song ideas and my songs and said, okay, well, let's write a bridge, you know. You need a bridge. Or, you know, you should do this four times instead of twice. Or, and then he even helped me sort of arrange some of the drum tracks even, you know. And help me sort of make them a little bit more cohesive, where they probably would have gone off in a few tangents. Because there are a couple songs that he wasn't involved in, and those are some of the songs that go off in tangents. And I'm happy for those songs to be like that. But there's also a lot of the more tight arrangements is where you really feel Dave's presence. You know,
pretty handy to have around.
You would say so. You know, you would think.
when you write these, do you ever have to differentiate between maybe taking the song to the Foo Fighters or keeping it for the Coattails?
No, because I mean, really, you know, the Foo Fighters is really, among other things, a vehicle for Dave's song.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really. I mean, I've had one song on a Foo Fighter record, and it was a double record, so there was a like kind of room for that sort of experimentation. But for the most part, we have 10 or 11, 12 songs on a record. And, you know, we only do a record every 2 or 3 years or something. So, you know, we focus on Dave's material, and that's kind of what the Foo Fighters is, you know. So I don't really, you know, hey, if he heard one of my songs and said, we're doing this in the Foo Fighters, I'd be like, yeah, great. But I don't really consider that an option for the most part.
Okay. Your vocals are sounding fantastic, by the way. They sound actually a lot stronger than they even have in the past. Is that something you've worked on, or has that just been kind of a natural thing?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think it just comes from doing it more, having a little bit more, just doing it, you know, being on the road and doing it. I've sang a lot more on the road, and I sang a little bit more backgrounds on Foo Fighter records, and, you know, I've spent a lot of time making sure the vocals were good, and I didn't want to auto-tune anything. You know, I didn't want to digitally change anything other than what you heard. So I definitely, you know, each song took, you know, a couple, 3 or 4 hours to get it exactly the way I wanted to get it, you know.
Like
so there was a lot of work that went into it, but I mean, probably no more than usual for most people, but I hope they've gotten better. I mean, that was definitely one of the things I focused on, was to try and make the vocals as strong as I could, you know. Yeah.
They really have. What are the summer plans for the Coattail Riders?
Well, we're, you know, getting ready to come to the East Coast and do a week or so on the East Coast. We're playing Boston. We're doing Baltimore. We're playing up in Toronto. We're doing a show in New York. We're doing a show in Philly. And then we head to London and play a show. And then we come back and we have some time off. And we're going to go do some festivals over in Europe. Hopefully do a show. I'm pretty sure we're doing a show in Japan, and pretty sure we're going to do a couple shows in Australia.
Cool.
And then it's time to come back to home base, which is the Foo Fighters.
You think it'll be another 4 years before we hear another record?
I mean, it'll be a little bit of time. There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as soon as I'm done sort of with this just sort of minimal amount of touring we're going to do with the Coattails, it's definitely going to be getting back to, you know, the Foo Fighters.
Right.
And that's my home. You know, that's my main priority.
Yeah.
And this is sort of like, I liken it to like almost having like a vacation home, you know. But the Foo Fighters are a family, and it's more than music. It's just, it's like our family, and it's our life, you know, and we've grown up together. And our families have grown up together, and, you know, we tour together. It's like a family. I'm also looking forward to coming home, you know, because I haven't been home for a year and a half.
Well, you really have made a fantastic record, and I do thank you for taking the time today.
Really, you can write my reviews then.
I will do so.
Thanks so much, dude.
Thank you. Have a good one out there.
Right on, dude.
And we'll be right back right after this.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. All right, now we're going to head up to 2023. In fact, both of my interviews with Chris Shiflett happened in the same year. This was earlier in the year, I think March 2023. We got to sit down to talk about his solo work. In fact, he just released the single Blacktop White Lines at this point. And he told us about writing with Jaron Johnson, the difference between his work in the Foos and co-writing his solo work. And that sound that he has, which is sort of like hot country meets ZZ Top, especially on that first single. So this is part two. Kyle Meredith with Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters.
Hey, how are you?
Foo Fighters, of course, people know you from that. They know you from your solo work. You've got a brand new single out called Blacktop White Lines. It's a fun track you got right here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to finally get it out. You know, these things like. Putting music out is always, it's a labor of love, but there's such a gap between when you record something and the excitement that you feel, like, you know, you go into the studio and you got this little idea and then it turns into this other thing and then you all come out of the studio, you're all stoked. And then it's like 2 years later, you finally get it out to the world, you know? So yeah, we set it free.
You know, the internet's made that easier. You can release music anytime. You can do it in a day if you want.
It's a funny thing because, you know, with my solo stuff, you know, it's like almost every time I make a record, we sort of have to go back out and figure out how we're going to put it out, you know? And it's really like, it's like that kind of stuff that just takes the long. So yeah, I mean, you could upload it and just put it out, but it's like, there's a bureaucratic layer, you know, that you kind of, it really helps to have in place, you know, like before you start putting stuff out.
The sexy part of rock and roll. That's what we're talking
exactly.
about here. Right.
Exactly. Meetings, folks, this is the music industry. We love meetings to discuss meetings.
Well, let's talk about this one because, yeah, I had read that the song had been around for a few years, but now that we do hear it, I mean, what do we have? A little song about revenge? Is that's what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's like it when we wrote it. You know, I wrote it with Jaron from Cadillac 3 and John from Brothers Osborne, and it was like smack dab in the middle of 2020 when we all found ourselves not on tour. And doing things like this over Zoom and writing and you know, I was here, I was literally like right here where I'm sitting right now in my little studio and would just come over here pretty much every day and kind of woodshed ideas and make little demos and stuff. And then I started like doing Zoom writes with people, which I'd never done before. You know, I don't know that I'd ever heard of Zoom prior to the lockdown.
None of us did. None of us did.
Yeah, you know, like, so it like opened up this whole trippy thing. But anyway, so like we're, you know, when we wrote that song, you know, I didn't have any plans. I knew it was about that time to like make another record, but the whole world was turned upside down. So I wasn't really thinking so much about that. And had just planned to write a song with Jaron. And then he was like, hey, what about John from Brothers? I'm like, fuck yeah, man, bring him. Great. And Jaron came in with that main riff, and then we just all started throwing out silly ideas. And next thing you know, we had our kind of like, you know, who is this person fleeing Alabama, and what did she do to Jimmy? And what did Jimmy do to get that done to him? You know, it's a mystery.
You can build a whole opera off of that if you want to.
I know.
There's your concept album right there. It's fun. It's fun though, coming up with those stories, especially when you're just because that's different, right? I mean, obviously, it's different than just, I don't know. As a songwriter, it seems like you do get to experience two completely different worlds. You know, maybe how the Foos write their music, and you know, I imagine like a lot of rock bands, like myself, when I was used to being, I'm like, they kind of form out of jam sessions in a lot of ways. But this seems a bit more methodical.
Well, it's interesting. Like with Foo Fighters, you know, Dave's the songwriter, and it varies from time to time. But normally he will like demo stuff, like do like an instrumental version of a riff or something, and then we'll learn it and play it together as a band a bit and jam on it, and then it sort of gets banged into shape. Writing with other people, yeah, I had never really done a whole lot of that before, outside of like whatever band I happened to be in, you know. But like sitting down and writing with folks that are your friends, or even just like going in cold with songwriters who have written stuff that you like or what, you know, whatever, like, is a real trip. It's a real different way of doing it. And things take twists and turns that like you would just wouldn't, you know, we all have our sort of like patterns, our well-worn patterns and ideas and stuff that we kind of lean on or just naturally kind of do or spill out of us. And I love that about writing with other people, that kind of gets like, you get away from that, you know, like I know what I sound like. I don't know necessarily what Jaron and John and whoever else I might have to write. Like the ideas that come out of those guys are totally different, you know? And like, I would have never like written this song on my own, you know what I mean? It had to be that group of people on that day, you know, throwing out whatever ideas were sort of popping into our heads. So it's cool, man. I mean, this song is the first song off a whole record that's coming later in the year. We've got some more like focus tracks or whatever coming out throughout the year, but there's a real like, it's probably like a 50-50 kind of thing in terms of songs that I just wrote, you know, by myself sitting here with like that guitar right there, just kind of noodling around, and then also songs that I wrote with other songwriter friends and stuff, and primarily Jaron. I mean, I worked on even songs that I wrote on my own, I took to Jaron, and since he produced it, like he had a massive impact and really it had a huge, you know, hand in how they ultimately turned out, you know.
What's a cool, you say starting with a riff. I mean, I hear that and I think, what's that little ZZ Top in there?
Sure. I mean, I heard it like real Eagles sounding, you know what I mean? But like then when we recorded it, it kind of veered into ZZ Top land a little bit, you know?
I guess I'm asking about the record as a whole, but like, does that come up like, oh, let's try it. Let's do it something that's in the style of X or the band X, but you know.
Sometimes, but I feel like it's more like the opposite. Like you go in with it, hearing it one way in your head and then it really takes a different turn. And maybe there's a, oh, we should, you know, what if we took the groove from like that old song or whatever? And then it kind of turns into something else. Like that album, West Coast Town, I did a few years ago, the title track was so different the way I wrote it. And when I played it for Dave Cobb, who produced that record, he like listened to it and then just said, was like, oh, we should do this one like Buck Owens. Cause the feel that I originally read it was so not that at all. It was almost more like, I don't know, like dum 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 dum, you know, it was like, had like a, I remember when I wrote it, I was like, man, that's the most like modern country thing I ever wrote at that time, you know? And then when we got into the studio, we turned it into the complete opposite, swinging it, you know, like classic country, 60s honky tonk kind of feel.
And that, and I'll say, you know, in all honesty, that part makes sense. You know, when we talk about, when your press release even talks about the LA to Nashville connection, you know, like my first thought anytime that comes up is like, oh yeah, Bakersfield, you know, you get that. And then when I hear something like this, it's like, oh wow, this is straight up like, this could live on Hot Country right here. Like I get surprised by that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think that's like the biggest difference with this record. And really this song, Blacktop White Lines, was for me, maybe the most sort of sonically different than stuff I'd done in the past. But yeah, it's definitely, the record as a whole, I think it's got a lot of all my influences, you know. I mean, there's some stuff that's like straight up, like, I don't know, alt rock or some shit, you know, and stuff that kind of leans, not, I wouldn't call it like punk rock, but like the stuff that kind of pulls from more of that vibe. And then, you know, the big through line for kind of everything I've probably ever done is like the Stones and that kind of classic rock kind of thing that kind of runs throughout it all. But then you sort of add in a bit of, like, you know, Jaron's like production gloss takes it into some different territory there too, you know. That would, it's funny because like making records like this, like I went out to Nashville for a few different sessions and recorded out there to get the record done. And when I'm in the studio, I'm playing with a bunch of, you know, different, a bunch of folks. I mean, mostly the same folks throughout the whole record. But it's a big room full of people playing, and I got, you know, Charlie Worsham playing guitar, and I got, you know, on some of it was Bukovac playing guitar, some of it was this dude, Nate Ketterly. And so I'm not really thinking about what everybody else is doing. I'm not thinking about like the kick drum pattern or what the bass player is doing necessarily. And there's a thing that happens where then I have to go learn it with a whole different group of musicians, like my band back here. And I got to sit down, I got to crack open the recordings, and I got to listen to what everybody's doing and try to figure out how we did it. You know what I mean? Because I know what I did, but I don't know what anybody else did, you know? And it's a funny thing. It's like, I always laugh about that. Like, you kind of have to go like learn your own record and see what's going on. Cause you know, I'm not really in there like micromanaging everybody. And then there's that thing of like having to kind of figure out like, well, I got to take a little bit of what Charlie did, and I got to take a little bit of what Nate did, and then I got to take what I did, and I got to figure out some way to sort of combo track that all together to go play it live, you know?
And especially, as they say, when you're working with, you know, the phrase Nashville cats. I mean, that's, it's incredible. I go down there every now and then, not for songwriting sessions, but I go down there actually quite often. But just talking to people who are in them sessions, and it is just like a complete trust that you can give just about anyone that you'd be working with. Like, I'm going to do my thing and you're going to do your thing, and it's going to be great.
Yeah. And your thing's going to be high level.
Right.
It's really great, man. I love that with, like, you know, with this record, you know, I got some great guitar players on this stuff, you know, and they're playing just cool guitar stuff that I wouldn't have come up with, you know. It just adds so much to it.
I saw you were at the Opry with Michael Cleveland, not a guitar player, fiddler, but we do a lot with him up here in Louisville, and man, that guy is incredible.
Yeah, that was really fun because I had recorded that song Long Long Year that I put out last year with Sierra Hull doing the mandolin and all the harmony vocals and stuff. And so when I went out to do the Opry around that, I asked her if she could come play the song with me. And then I was like, well, this is like, you know, this is like a good moment here. Like, we got to take advantage of this. So I asked her if she could corral some of her bluegrass friends and come up and do a tune, which we did, that kind of Jimmy Martin ish version of Truck Driving Band. And she put together a great lineup of players, and it was just, I mean, wow, what a fun thing, you know. For that's like so out of my wheelhouse, and just, it's just a, like, moments like that that are a real treat, you know, where you're like, man, I don't get to do this too often. And it's like a nice, this warm bed of really great players that I can just kind of strum my acoustic guitar and let them, you know, burn.
Let it do it. Have you noticed, like, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been talked about, especially in circles, but the LA to Nashville exodus in the past few years, that's been fun to watch as a sort of outsider to it, but it seems like so natural at this point. Is it that pipeline?
Yeah, and that's been going on for so long. I feel like it's already probably happened and peaked, and probably, you know, those people are probably now moving somewhere else because like Nashville's too built up or something. You know what I mean? I was wondering like what kind of impact that's had musically to have all these LA people head out there. I'm sure it must have with all those players. But yeah, you know, Nashville was that place, I think, for a few years ago where you could you know, still get a better deal on a house and all that, you know, have a yard and have a little space and all that thing. Although I suspect with the way that it's been built up, that that's probably come and gone, I'm guessing.
We get the spillover here now. Yeah, we get the spillover in Louisville now is what's happening, which.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it was just fun. No complaints there.
I mean, it's wild. I was just talking about that with my manager, Shane, this morning, because I had to drive out to, you know, Foo Fighters Studios out in the valley. I live over on the west side, and I had to drive a piece of gear out there and drop it off. And driving back, it should be like a 20-minute drive. It took me an hour and change or something to get back here, you know what I mean? And I was like, I keep hearing about all these people that are leaving LA, but what, like, are twice as many people fucking moving here? Cause it's more crowded than ever, you know?
Oh man, we can't handle your spillover. That's too far. That's not going to work.
I know.
So the album, as you're saying, it's going to be out what, later this year?
Yeah. 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 I think in October, and we've got, Blacktop just came out, and then there's, three more tunes coming out, I think we spaced them like 10 weeks apart, something like that. So it sort of takes you through into the fall.
You know, outside of a song like Blacktop, which is its own sort of fictional, I would assume maybe fictional, hoping fictional. But like, you know, I think I read somewhere like it's been one of your most transitional years as writing this record. What does that mean in relation to what you have been writing?
Yeah, it was a trip putting this together, you know. I'm not like one of those writers that sits and just writes all the time, you know? And I always admire people that do. It's just never been, that's never been my sort of discipline with it. I tend to like right now, and for the last little while, I've been in the mode of like getting the record out and, you know, getting the band together and planning the shows and, you know, all that sort of detail stuff, among other things. And, so when I'm like, I always feel like with writing, I always, you know, I'll come up with little ideas and stuff, and I'll just record it into my phone. And it's almost like it starts to bubble up and ideas are kind of percolating and more. It's almost like they're like, it gets to a point where it's like overflow. And then you like almost like have to just sit and woodshed and put them all together. You know, it'd be probably be a much better writer if I just sat down every day and chipped away at it, you know, but in all honesty, I don't. I just like if other things, I'm constantly, my life is so compartmentalized between Foo Fighters and my family and my solo stuff and, you know, whatever other handful of things I might get into, my podcast and, you know, stuff like that. Much less just like finding the time to get to the gym or maybe go for a surf or whatever. It's like, it's almost like it turns into like, it's like you, it starts to overflow and you have to just kind of sit and get it out of you, you know?
But it's, I feel like you'd have to have trust in yourself that knowing that when that time does come that, you know, that there would be like, Jacob Dylan, that's who I was trying to think of, having him on here. We've talked about it a few times because he rarely writes, and he only starts writing when it's time to make an album. It's like, oh, it's time to make an album? Well, I better come up with 10 songs then. Right. I'm like, wow. I mean, that's having some trust in yourself that there will be some actual material there.
Yeah, I think the real thing is like, you know, it's really easy to get carried away with how you think you're supposed to do it, you know? And there's a lot of people, I mean, you know, there's like music girl songwriters that I'm friends with and I admire a lot that they can sit there and do like 3 writes in a day, 5 days a week and like get good shit done. I mean, I just imagine their writing muscles must be so fucking strong, you know? But I mean, it's the reality is it's like different strokes for different folks. And like, you know, songwriters who I love, like John Doe, you know, from X, like, I asked him about that when I interviewed him, and he was just like, yeah, I write when it's time to write. You know, when I feel like writing, I write, you know? And I think that's for me, that's like a better kind of approach to it. It's like, I don't think it makes any sense for me just to feel some like I have to do this today or whatever. It's just like when the ideas come, they come. And I mean, there definitely is a thing though, too. Like when the ideas come, you got to chase it down. It's always better to chase it down as it's coming to you. That thing like, oh, I'll get to that. later. I have a phone filled with ideas that I thought I was going to get to that I'm never going to get to. That half the time you listen to them, you're like, what was I thinking on that? You know, what is that? And then nothing there. But yeah, it's for what I do for my life, for my lifestyle, it's just all, I'm just always juggling, you know, which is great. I mean, I love it. Like, I love that I got a lot on my plate, you know, and it's a good place to be. I mean, I just feel like I'm just kind of working on music in one way or another kind of all the time. And
that's the dream.
Yeah.
That's the dream. So do you have to, then you plan it as we started the, I'll bring it full circle. You got to plan, I guess, around Foo Fighters, like, oh, that's happening this year. I'm doing this year, and then vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, it's the tough thing squeezing in, you know, when to do solo stuff here and there, because, you know, like, Foo Fighters is a full time band. That's a life. It's not even a band. It's such a massive part of your life, you know, and it's the priority, you know, of course. So yeah, there's that, and there's always something going on there, and then there's my family, and that's the other. It's like those two things, and then there's sort of all the other stuff I do, just kind of in the margins, you know.
When you got to create, you got to create. I understand that. That's yeah. A little obsession we have. I so enjoy listening to what you do. I didn't even bring up the other songs, "Born and Raised" and "Long, Long Year." I mean, you're putting out great work here.
Oh, thank you. Well, I can't wait for you to hear the next one. It's called "Dead and Gone," and it should be out in about 9 weeks.
All right. I'll be looking forward to it and seeing you guys again eventually with the Foos. I did catch a couple, right before the pandemic. I haven't seen you guys since, you know, before the pandemic and all that. So
I think we're coming out your way this summer, I believe.
I will travel there every time, wherever I need to be.
Awesome.
Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it. It's been really cool.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, man. Appreciate it.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith. So part three of this Foo Fighters retrospective finds me talking with Chris Shiflett once again later on in 2023. He had just released the album Lost at Sea, and we got to discuss his history with Americana and country rock music, how he finds the most interesting guitar playing coming from country music and bands like Social Distortion and X, and how they bridge the gap between punk and Americana. Part three of the Foo Fighters retrospective. It's Kyle Meredith with Chris Shiflett.
Hey, how are you?
This might be the quickest return guest. Like, I have my usuals, my yearly guests, but I don't know that I've had anyone on, because we talked early in the year. You had a new single out, but now the album Lost at Sea is finally here. And I can say finally, because this is a multi-years journey for you.
It really is. Yeah, I feel like I put this record out 2 years ago, like internally. But you know, I'm happy that it's finally that the full length's finally coming out, because like you said, we've been putting songs out all year and doing some shows around all that, but it'll be great to have the full length out. It's a labor of love, but it really, like, it takes so long to figure out how you're gonna put out your record and then get it all together and get the artwork together and do all that stuff. And you know, as a musician, you want to put it out like the day you get the final mix, but it just never works out that way. So, you know, I've been living with these songs for a minute, and I'm just glad to let them loose, let them fly.
Well, you know, the compliments, the more and more I listen to it, I think surely there's lots of thought that's went into the sequencing of this as well, because it, at times it almost feels like a story. It almost feels linear, if that makes sense.
That's
even
right.
Even starting with Dead and Gone and ending with Parties, which are two very different things, but for some reason, even comically, they almost feel like they, you know, are the perfect bookends to everything that happens in the middle.
All right. Yeah, that's great to hear. It is funny, because you do put a lot of thought into the sequencing. I always think of sequencing as like, if the album were a gig, you know, you want it to sort of like have ebbs and flows and jump up at some points and kind of mellow out at some, you know, and that whole thing. So, but it's great That's nobody has said that to me yet, so I appreciate that. Because you know, you write, like, all these songs were written in that time, like right before I started making the record or during making the record, except for Damage Control, the only old one that was on there. So, like, unintentionally, there is some through line through it all, you know, because it's just the things that you're thinking about in that little time period, you know, the things that are on your mind, and so it all kind of, it does sort of form a like a little snapshot of 2020, 2021.
Well, especially when any artist, I think, you know, writes, as you said, sort of all the songs come almost around the same time. Inevitably, not only do you get the through line, but you'll get some of those words, you know, the same words will pop up multiple. And there are multiple ones, but the two I centered on were birthdays and damage.
I know. What's the deal with birthdays? Why does that keep popping? Because that's not even just this album. I was thinking about that the other day. Like, how many songs have I written about my birthday, my wife's birthday, somebody's birthday, you know what I mean? It seems to pop up. The one that my wife calls me out on all the time is, she's like, how many times are you gonna write that you reference PCH? Like, just stop, you can't ever reference PCH again. And enough with the swear words. So that's my goal for my next record is there's gonna be no beach references. How about that? I get it. I live by the beach. I love the beach, but enough of that. And it's going to be entirely clean.
You know, I was, I had Ronnie Dunn from Brooks and Dunn on last year, and his record that he put out last year had Whiskey and Neon in every single song, I believe, on the record. Yeah. So you didn't do that.
Yeah. Well, at least he's consistent. Yeah.
So much of I know when people talk to you about your solo music, especially if they're new to it, knowing your history either from pre-Foo Days or the Foo Fighters, it's always like, what? Where the hell did this come from? And it's funny hearing those in the interviews because I watch some of your interviews and it seems to pop up. But it's, I know the long history is there. I did want to back up sort of pre this album and everything. When did you start digging into the type of music that you sort of have found yourself doing in your solo work?
Well, I've been listening to it for a long time, but I never tried to play anything that sort of had that influence, you know, that sort of like country and Americana influence until the first Dead Peasants record that I made. But even that was a long time ago. It is a funny thing, you know, I've talked about this before, but I have a lot of friends in country music and Americana and, you know, in that sort of side of music. And nobody from that side of the aisle ever says like, what, you like rock music? You know what I mean? And yet everybody from the rock side of the music is like, what, you like country? You know, like I honestly don't get why that's such a shock. I just don't, like, you know what I mean? To people, like, they're not that far apart musically, especially nowadays. Jesus, like, country and rock music are like my personal theory is that like all genres are slowly melting into the same sound, which I think holds up. If you listen to just about anything, it's all kind of the same production styles or kind of run through, whether, and I mean like whether it's pop music or R&B or rock and roll or country or anything, there's a lot of overlap nowadays, in a way that was not the case like when I was growing up, when everything seemed very separate, you know. And that's cool. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's cool. But I think like, and I think even just like, there's a lot of overlap in with people's musical tastes, like the people that like country music and people that like alt rock and stuff. I do think there's a lot there. So I don't know. It's. I'm a guitar player. I love guitar playing, and all the good guitar playing, I hate to say it, but the most interesting guitar playing has been in country music for a long time. It ain't in rock music. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff going on in rock music too, but for the type of guitar playing that I like, way more interesting. My taste. I'm not saying like this is some grand judgment, but my taste leans more to country pickers. And I think a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that like, that's not what I grew up in. It's not really what's in my hands. I like playing, you know, stuff that's kind of country influenced, but it's not like, it doesn't sound like that when I do it. It sounds like an old rock hack trying to play some, you know, Don Rich licks or whatever, you know, and that's what I like, you know?
I mean, I grew up in rural Kentucky. So I grew up, you know, before I moved to the big city of Louisville, you know, it was, you had top 40 radio and country radio. And so I, you know, 80s and 90s country, like that's, I know it all, I, you know, and that's, it's all there. But even, you know, when I'm not saying anything new here, when I first heard Social Distortion, that's what I recognized in Social D, you know, and what
sure.
they were doing, because that was there. It's not, to your point, it's not so surprising because those mixtures have always been there.
Yeah.
It is funny to see people's revelations when they hear this and to, you know, the oh my god sort of thing. Like it's got an interesting point, you know, especially being in your seat.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. Like I think like country music is sort of like one of the last things people can kind of openly make fun of. It's I don't know why. It's like to people who don't listen to country, they just think that all country music is the one version of the corniest hee-haw version of it that you can point your finger at, as opposed to what it really is, which is this massive, you know, it's a huge umbrella. It's a big tent. You know, there's a lot of different sounds and there's a lot of different styles in it. And there's the poppier side and there's the rootsier side and there's everything in between. And yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. It's just a funny thing with people have a sort of a bias in a weird way. You know what I mean? It's funny.
Well, I'm glad you're bridging that gap.
I'm glad you mentioned Social Distortion, because really, like, you know, I came out of like rock music and heavy metal and then punk rock eventually. And Social D, like, I was like obsessed. Like when Prison Bound came out, like that record totally changed my life. And it's not like it was a country record by any stretch of the imagination, but there were songs on it that like a song like Prison Bound, you know, that had a more of a, like a, almost like a, you know, country style narrative. And then Social D would always throw in like cover songs of, you know, a big loud version of an old honky tonk song or something. And between them and bands like X that dabbled in some of that as well, like that really, as much as like, you know, my old Stones records that would have, you know, Dead Flowers or whatever on it that would sort of lean a little bit that way. I mean, that was sort of like that mixed with 90s alt country was sort of that was my way in, you know?
And you know, and yeah, because what John Doe after X, like he's become a great Americana singer. And I think, you know, and there's, I know there's more examples of that. Like that seemed like a natural path for a lot of folks that started in punk to go that way, you know, for whatever reason.
Sure.
Yeah.
I know the reason, because you get older and you just, you know, your tastes slow down a little and mellow out a little and you lean a little more on the lyrics and, you know, all that. It makes sense.
I mean, and to that point, it's surprising the people who haven't. And again, this is not a judgment, you know, for the people who have felt like they've had to stay in the lane, like they're held to a sound. I'm thinking like Billy Idol or something like that, you know. If he puts out music, it's still got to be Billy Idol. It's still got to be a little bit of that big arena punk from the 80s or something like that, you know. It's like
we just actually played with Billy Idol. Where was that? At a festival up in Aspen. It was so good. He came out and he did a Pistol song with us. It was great.
And that's what I'm saying. No judgment. I love Billy and love seeing what he's done and his new records. But it's the choices you make as an artist. But some of those find the way out, and some artists are like, this is the box that I'm in.
Well, so, you know, I mean, I think it sort of depends on the artist. If it's like AC/DC or the Ramones, like clearly that's like those bands had a sound, or in the case of AC/DC, have a sound. And I, you know, I don't know how much it's that they didn't want to deviate from it, or if it's just that that's what came out of them naturally, which is what I suspect it more sort of is, you know. It is a funny thing with music. It's like people want, you get criticized if you do the same thing, a similar thing for a long time, but then you get criticized if you don't too. So it's you know, pick your poison. You know, if at the end of the day, if you're lucky enough to have a long career, like, you're just gonna catch some shit one way or another.
But hearing songs on here like God, I love Carrie Midnight Texas Queen. I don't know how you can't not like that song.
Oh, you know, thank you. I was thinking about that song today because I'm actually in Austin. I'm gonna play a solo gig at Antone's tonight. And things have been really busy, but I was like, oh man, we should have figured that one out. We should have got that, worked that one up in the set. It's like about here, like literally here.
But that's those moments in there where I hear all the multiple influences coming at once. And not that we have to go further down that, but where did that song come from at all? Because, you know, I know you did some co-writing this, and I think we were talking about the single earlier this year, was it Blacktop White Lines? Is that the name of it?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Like we were talking about characters, like the use of characters, not so much biographical. Is this one of those moments?
This one was actually just a song title that I had, written in a notebook that was just, the title was inspired by an actual, you know, a gal that I used to know, but I don't know why I wrote that down one day, just Carrie Midnight, Texas Queen, like, and it just sat there for, I think for years, you know, and I kept thinking, oh man, I got to write that song. And then I got together with Carrie and Nick to write. And I don't remember exactly how we got onto it, but you know, usually when you're doing those things, you know, everybody's like, well, I got this idea, or what if we, you know, I got this idea. And for whatever reason, we jumped into it and wrote that. And it was sort of, you know, it's definitely not like a straight up diary entry or anything. It's kind of embellishing on the facts a little bit just to make it have a narrative and a flow to it. But I was really happy with how that one came out, because a lot of times when you write with other people, you know, it's the beauty of it is that you get a bunch of different people's perspective. The part that can be a little challenging if it's the song that you're going to record is that you sort of start to lose your connection to it, because it's for exactly the same reason, because lyrically it's no longer your story. But that one somehow it kept, you know, I don't know, it just worked, you know, and writing with those guys was great. And it was one of those songs that that just kind of came together pretty fast. I mean, I remember when we recorded it too, like we were the first like mix of it, or rough board mix of it, it was all just a little too clean and nice, you know. My guitar sounded a little too nice. And I that one was definitely one of the ones I was like, it sounds like, I don't know, it's just a little, it was like maybe uncomfortable because it was a little too straightforward. So I went in and roughed it up a little bit, you know, after the fact.
That we're talking about it and you mentioning Austin and everything, and Bob Schneider, you familiar with Bob?
He was Bob Schneider.
He's one of the big, he's like, for a long time was like the king of Austin singer songwriters anyway.
Ah,
yeah. Worth checking out if you're not, but he's got a few songs in that style anyway. And it's like, all right, this you didn't mean to, but it just makes sense in this whole world, this Austin galaxy of music, you know, that's down there.
Yeah. I mean, I was like really kind of like pulling from memories of when I was in No Use for a Name, and we would always tour through Texas and you'd play emos or whatever. And I don't know, that was always a good stronghold for our band and just for that scene. You know, the shows were always really good down in Texas.
Parties. I mentioned that closing out the album. Is that an actual thing that you're dealing with? Have you?
Yeah, I don't get invited to parties. It's true. For a lot of reasons. I definitely, like, you know, I mean, I was thinking about an actual dinner that had happened that the week that I wrote it, where I just seemed like I was just out of step with the conversational flow of the entire table. But also it's a little bit too, like, and I don't like to dwell on this too much, you know, I got sober a long time ago, and that's kind of an element of that song too, is when you sort of remove yourself from the wing ding, eventually you just stop getting invited, you know.
I do know, and something about that, it's just getting older too. It's,
yeah,
there's a Walkman lyric, the band The Walkman, from their big single The Rat. I loved it because I think Hamilton Lighthouser wrote this line when he was in his early 20s, which was hilarious to me, because the line is, when I used to go out, I knew everyone I saw. Now I go out alone, if I go out at all. It's like, it's sort of like when Joni sings Both Sides now, you know, at 19 and at, you know, 60 or 70 or whatever. It's like how,
totally, yeah.
Yeah. Those lyrics.
I know that feeling well.
It is funny how, you know, the lyrics, I don't know how they speak at different points in your life or something like that. But even the heavy subject of that song, by the way, it's a fun one. And Dead and Gone too. I mean, the whole thing, I love it. But you also have these, you know, I'm hitting on these more party moments of the record, but like, we've been playing Overboard in heavy rotation on FPK here in Louisville. And
really?
Yeah, that's such a good song. And then when I hear What Weighs You Down, and I think that's one of the most interesting, sweet songs, way to be sweet in a song that I think I've ever heard.
And it's about a birthday.
And it's about a birthday.
Of course it's about a birthday. How could it be about anything else?
Do you remember getting were that inspiration when it hit?
100%. Yeah. I mean, that the song was built around, I was playing my baritone guitar, which guitar players out there will know has a very specific kind of thing to it. And just started playing that riff. And I was just, you know, noodling around on that. And then really just built the song around it, around that. And I just thought, oh, if we could come up with a good groove for this, it'd be a nice, it could be a nice, you know, hooky riff. But lyrically, it was inspired by my wife's birthday, you know, and that thing of like, you know, that we all deal with getting older and, you know, sort of reflecting on that, you know, I don't know. Like, it's not always an easy thing to sort of realize, oh, my back's sore all the time. And look at all this gray hair. And, you know, like, not to say that my wife was struggling with that, but it's more me projecting on her, you know. And also trying to just kind of say, like, you know, whatever, it's just a number. Look at how great our life is, you know. Like, that's the references to our kids and stuff like that, you know.
It really is just one of the most sweet songs, and in such a different way than I've usually heard that. I mean,
oh, thank you.
Yeah. The other side of everything that you're doing, you've got this great podcast that I've been enjoying called Shredding with Shifty. And this is still sort of a new series for you, right? This comes after Walking the Floor. Is that just a business thing? I mean, why did you make the shift?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had done Walking the Floor for a long time. For, you know, around 10 years or so. And I just needed to do something different, really, is what it came down to. I loved doing it. It was super fun. But at a certain point, I just got tired of hearing my own voice in that context and just wanted to do something. And even just the way I just wanted to put it out a little bit differently and sort of be able to assemble a team to help out, because with Walking the Floor, it was just like a one-man show. But it's been great, you know. This first season has just like exceeded all expectations for the guests. You know, we've had some really good ones so far, and there's a bunch that aren't out yet that are great. Like, we just put out Brad Paisley, but we're about to put out Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke is the next one. Blake from Jawbreaker, Mike McCready, Mike Campbell from the Heartbreakers. There's a whole bunch, and we're honing in on the final, you know, four or five guests that were, I was able to do like 10 or 11 interviews, you know, before I left for tour. And then so we got to get that, the last batch done here before too long, but it's been really great, man. So it's been, I've learned a lot about guitar, which, you know, it's a deep dive on guitar playing and everything connected to it with all the gear and all that stuff. But it's also like, you know, having all these different players sort of, you know, really get into the weeds on how they built these guitar solos and even just the songs themselves. It's been a real blast.
You get origin stories of stuff I've done.
Yeah.
Like the rivers. I mean, like, I like how you're doing it, because it's not like you're just jumping straight in to the gear talk and the riff talk or whatever. Like, it's set up really, really nicely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's great. Like, my hope is that you know, that I can talk to all these people who I'm a fan of and just, and hopefully it's different than like their normal interview that they do, where we can really spend some time just kind of casually talking about stuff. But hopefully, like, you know, it gets into like the type of conversation you would have with somebody backstage, or the type of conversation you would have if you're both recording in the same studio and you're hanging out in the lounge having a coffee and, you know, what's, man, what are you playing on that track? You know, there's that kind of stuff. You know, that's sort of my hope for it.
I'm hoping it inspires some people too. I was talking with a friend of mine who I used to play with 20 years ago, and we were talking about, I'd bought a pedal that I had 20 years ago. And he goes, you know, kids now, they don't even use pedals. It's all like, you know, the computer samples and preamps and all that stuff. I'm like, I didn't even, and he's like, they don't even use amps. You know, it's like, you can't even do this kind of gear talk with this young generation. It's like, I'm totally lost on that. It's,
oh, dude, you're playing through a deluxe reverb simulator. So sick.
Like, cool.
I can't make fun of that because I do a bit of that myself with my solo thing. And I absolutely love it.
It's a different world.
I get it. It really is, man. If you cannot have to load your Marshall half stack in the back of your car to get down to the gig, I'm like all for it.
Well, I appreciate all you do. I love hearing this new series. The new record is so good. Lost at Sea. Congrats on finally getting it out, man.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we got to get another one together here soon. I saw Jaron the other day. I was like, man, it's just about that time. Let's go.
Start working. I mean, if it takes you 3 years to get one out, yeah, you probably should start.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, at least now we've got a team, you know. Now we got a whole team built. So now we can, you know, hopefully the next one will be like, just get it right out.
I appreciate you taking the time as always, man. It's great to catch up with you.
Awesome. Yeah, man. Good to see you, pal.
And my thanks to Chris and the late, great Taylor Hawkins and all the Foo Fighters. Thanks to you, of course, for checking out the episode. Before you get out of here, hit that subscribe button so you get new interviews like this one sent to you every single week. You can find us at Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern, 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s, the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Tori Amos, Bjork, Kate Bush, The Devil Makes Three, Super Suckers, Van Morrison, Lou Reed, Anthrax, Lucinda Williams, Fontaine's D.C., Odd Marshall, Sonny War, The Pixies, Kirsty MacColl, and my interview with Alice Cooper. That's what you can hear weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.